and welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Inside Education is the weekly programme and podcast for anyone interested in any aspect of education. Podcasts of over 340 previous episodes can be downloaded from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Anne O'Gara, my former colleague, who stepped down earlier this year from her role as President of Merino Institute of Education, after spending 12 years at the helm there. Last week, I mentioned the unique combination of positions Anne O'Gara held in education, from primary school teacher to Deputy National Coordinator of the Homeschool Community Liaison Scheme, and from schools inspector to college president. Last week, we talked about leadership in education, and this week, I talked to Anne about other aspects of her career, beginning with her time in the inspectorate. I noted that inspectors often arouse conflicting emotions among teachers, and then asked how she perceives the role played by inspectors in our education system.
I think inspectors do have a role. I actually would be quite definite that I think there is a role for external evaluation. The emphasis that there is now on school self-evaluation and encouraging schools to take time to reflect on their procedures, but also on their teaching and learning, and to create a learning environment, a learning organisation. I think that's really, really, really important. But I do think sometimes it is important also to get that external verification. I know it caused a little bit of angst in Merino the first time that the Teaching Council would have come to review our teacher education programmes. The Teaching Council was looking for volunteers, and we volunteered our programme to have that external review. And I think the reason that I would have embraced it was that I am convinced that external validation is important for people, while at the same time that I would always encourage people to be reflective. It also depends on the purpose for the visit. Some of the purposes can be quite policy orientated. In other instances, the purpose can be that there is a good practice that is being encouraged in schools. It is a very privileged role to be able to actually have, as I had, 45 schools, 484 teachers that you can visit on a cyclical basis. So I think while teachers might be ambivalent towards the inspectorate, when it came to the inspectorate withdrawing from initial teacher education and in the context of probation, that is still causing quite an amount of grief within the system. So I think teachers might be a little bit ambivalent about inspectors.
You see, I think it's fine if the inspector is going in to validate, but if an inspector goes in and sees things that they need to criticise, either in a classroom or in a school more generally, that's a difficult position for everyone. How did you deal with those kinds of situations?
In any school situation, it's not all bad or all good. How anyone gives feedback is you need to be able to find some successes and being able to actually at the same time balance the feedback that you give, because you can't go in and leave a trail of destruction after yourself. And so inspectors have to make judgments around what to actually articulate, and within that being able to actually see that these, no more than my own commitment to change management, that it's small incremental steps. So working those out in collaboration with either an individual teacher or with the principal, or with the whole staff in the context of whole school evaluation and the board of management of a school, does need to be broken down. It is really important to take it in small steps and to be able to see, okay, what needs to be done in the short term, what can be left to the more medium and the long term. But I think it's developing a trust also between the inspector and the principal of the school and senior management within the school, that's really important.
You see, I think it's not even so much necessarily that the inspector leaves a trail of destruction, as maybe some teachers, some can be more sensitive to than others to criticism. And even if you give lots of positives and you give one critical point, that's the point that I'm going to remember a year later.
That's the same scenario that we experience all the time when people go out on, whether it's a school visit for some of our student teachers, or whether it's on internships in relation to our education studies and our early childhood education students, giving feedback is not easy. All of us find negative feedback difficult. I think in my own case, what I tend to do is park it for a little while and go back to it. It's one of the things that I would often say to somebody when an issue or a matter arises is, okay, take a few deep breaths. It's really important to address negative feedback, but I think maybe it needs to be done in a measured fashion, and that sometimes is hard. And I don't think any of us can actually come up with an easy way to do it.
If you were to think back over all the teachers and all the schools that you've visited as an inspector, and you were to kind of say, you know, take qualities of different teachers, what are those qualities that make a really good teacher, and what are the qualities that make a really good school? You could do either, you know, you can kind of answer that question whatever way you want, but I'm just kind of interested if you were to, you know, combine all the best of what you saw.
Yeah, I think there's two elements, and we used to call it the hidden curriculum and then children's learning. And if you ask me what was the hardest thing to describe, was in fact the kind of teaching that allowed me to understand that the children were learning well and that all children in the class were learning well. That's very difficult. It's multi-layered, we all know that. I found sometimes I got stopped in my tracks, even though I had been teaching for a long time. And I think the piece that I would focus on with respect to teaching that was a big change over the time of my teaching career and then observing it was hearing the voice of the children themselves. I think I might have told this story before, but in my own diploma, when I was doing my diploma in when I came out of college, and in my day you did two diplomas, and I had this kicker, P.S.O. Cleric. He was a very nice man. He came into my classroom and I actually got a good diploma. But his comment at the end of the day was that I was working the hardest in the class. I was the person who was working the hardest in the classroom. And I actually found that that's something I have reflected on in my various different roles over my 40 years in education, to try and actually not be the person who was working the hardest, or at least taking the time to step back and reflect. So I think teachers who set up learning situations, and I'll give an example. There was a class, a fifth class, that were going to go on a school tour to the art gallery. In advance of the school tour to the art gallery, the children were encouraged to research and to choose in groups a painting that they wanted to see in real life. And they chose their painting, they found out about who the artist was, etc., etc. Now, the class would have been maybe 30 and divided into six or four or five children or whatever in each group. And so they went off to the gallery, and while they were there, they had already developed a list of questions that they wanted answered from the experience. But when they came back, they each grouping developed a PowerPoint presentation together, and they shared with each other what it was about the painting that attracted them in the first instance, what they had learned about the artist, what their experience was in the art gallery. And it was magic, because the children actually enjoyed not just the experience of how they had in fact looked and responded to one piece of art, but through the engagement and of listening with other children, they actually became much more familiar with a range of different pieces in the art gallery at the time. Now, that teacher facilitated a learning situation, but the range and the breadth of the skills being developed in those children was so much broader than what's written down in learning outcomes for any lesson plan. So I suppose I would always be interested in those people who have a little bit of creativity. Another example was a teacher in a school where there was a child with special educational needs. And again, it was a senior class. It was history. But two of the other children had taken the chapter that they were doing that week in history and had summarized it and they had scanned the photographs of the chapter. And so the child with special educational needs was reading the same chapter as everybody else, but the language had been mediated by children in the class. And so differentiating the learning and also creating learning situations that involve the children in supporting each other around their learning are just two examples of the instances that I remember from my time as an inspector.
That's so interesting, and the examples really do make it more concrete.
Well, it's funny actually, talking about concrete examples, going back to when I worked as a homeschool community liaison coordinator, I will never forget the conversation with one of the children, because a number of the homes that I would have visited as a homeschool coordinator would have had a very small kitchenette that wouldn't really have had enough room for a table. It would have had, in many instances, a sitting room with a very large TV. So this child explained to me that the best place in her house to do her homework was on the stairs, because she could sit on one and do her writing on another. And so the ability of children to actually make the best of various different situations in order to, you know, enhance their learning, you know, I'm always, you know, marvel at the range and the breadth of what they can come up with. But that is a scenario equally that has stayed with me over the time, and the challenges that can be there for some children in order to do things that we as teachers would expect that they could do without any bother.
Another portion of your career, Anne, was spent with the Homeschool Liaison Scheme. What is the idea of that scheme?
Well, our constitution would say parents are the primary educators of their children. Children spend only 15% of their waking life between when they're born and 18 in school. They're 85% of their time in their home and in their community. So to have a disconnect between home and school is certainly not logical in the context of supporting children's learning. So what was behind the Homeschool Liaison Scheme was not that parents and teachers do the same thing. And I think that was one of the things and one of the fears of many teachers in the beginning. It is that their roles are complementary in the context of the child's learning. And so that sense that homeschool community liaison coordinators try to develop of a partnership between parents and teachers. And that partnership based on a shared sense of purpose, which was to support their child's learning, mutual respect and willingness to negotiate. And they were all kind of concepts that were quite new. It was quite interesting, I suppose, in a way, in that I had watched over many years, you know, the development of you know, say boards of management were introduced in 1975, in parents' associations in 1985. And yet when I did my own doctoral research, which was in fact on consultation with parents in the development of the school plan, I would have found that across the schools that I would have surveyed, there was in fact a spectrum of engagement with parents. And just because a school was very small didn't necessarily mean that the relationships between parents and teachers were any better. In fact, it did require a very concerted effort from the school to go out to parents and to bring parents in. And I'll give one example. I have a sister who's a solicitor, and the way we learned spelling at home in our house was that my mother would have a back of an envelope or somewhere, and she'd call out the spelling and you'd write your spellings down. And if you got a spelling wrong, you put over the other side and you wrote it out three times correctly, and then you actually got the test again. All of the spellings again, not just the one that you got wrong. So my sister would have learnt by a kind of a look-see. She equally would have learnt her letters as A, B, C, D. And when her daughter went to school, and certainly my senior infants, was doing word families at bat cat, Aisling, my sister, didn't know anything about bu and cu and whatever. And so there was a disconnect between the way she had learned. And sometimes I think as teachers, we didn't in the past communicate well enough with parents in relation to our approach. And we weren't confident enough that there's a whole range of skills and abilities around and learning that we have actually gone through that is just as important, in fact, and just as detailed as, you know, what other professionals, whether they're nurses or whether they're tradesmen like carpenters or whatever, have to find out. And sometimes I think we don't necessarily celebrate that enough and aren't confident enough in that regard with respect to parents. But I actually do think it's changed quite dramatically. I mean, I know now a number of principals of junior infant classes, and, you know, there are now welcome mornings when parents come into the school and when the teachers go through their plan of activity over the following week, and that little packs are sent home in relation to whether it's supporting their child around nursery rhymes or, you know, a particular sound that is the sound of the week. I think those elements are really, really important.
And you were involved at the very start or very early in the homeschool liaison movement in Ireland. What did that work involve?
I was assistant national coordinator of the homeschool liaison scheme, and elements of that work were about going and visiting schools and introducing the scheme to new schools, explaining it to school staff, explaining the way in which the coordinator, their role, and what the priorities within that role were. An element of the one priority would have been home visits, and would have been home visits that were quite different to the kinds of visits that, in fact, a school attendance officer would do. So it was a building a bridge between parents and teachers, but you weren't going out with bad news all the time. And so in many instances and in designated areas of disadvantage, the only times that parents would have been called to the school, they'd have been asked to come up to meet with either the teacher or the principal because there were issues around attendance or behaviour in class or homework or whatever. Significantly, it has also changed now in relation to the support being given around learning support and resource teaching, significantly more involvement of parents in the development of IEPs, etc. So I suppose what my job in homeschool liaison, and I at the time would have had fantastic schools in Finglas, Ballymun, Blanchardstown, Mulhuddin and Cabra. I had schools in the Midlands, mostly second level schools that would have been community colleges. Maybe they had been the old tech and they would have in fact had designated areas of disadvantage status. And so I had schools in Moat, Clara, Kilbeggan, Newbridgeth High, and I also then had Cork City and County. So it gave me a great breadth. And I suppose in coming to a teacher education college, it meant that I could actually bring all of that breadth and experience with me. I think we're very, very fortunate in Ireland that we're continuing to attract high caliber young people into teacher education at all levels, you know, in the system. And I think one of the areas that will need to be addressed into the future is, in fact, the further education and training for the early years sector. It's something that has lagged behind in this country, but there are signs of hope in the changes that have occurred over the last short number of years.
In your role in the homeschool liaison scheme, you worked alongside Dr. Concepta Connaughty. What are your memories of Concepta?
You know, I mentioned earlier on that I was considered formidable by some of my friends. I think a lot of people would have considered Concepta very formidable. She was a woman who had an incredible vision for change in relation to the way in which the school and parents and the community would work together. And she fostered that. And I think in a way in which you can have structural change, such as, for example, setting up parents' associations. But many parents' associations are involved primarily with fundraising to support the school, maybe helping out with things like sports days, etc. Concepta's vision of the engagement between the school and the parents was quite different. Education disadvantage and how that was perceived prior to Concepta was much more of a deficit model. It was in fact calling parents up when there was a matter or an issue, whereas Concepta's model was much more about, based on Frary and based on training for transformation, that it was about empowering parents in their role as the primary educators of their children. And she was extremely passionate about staying with the journey of parents, because many parents, their own life experience with respect to education, they might have had matters or issues with school. For them, it was quite traumatic to come back into the school with their child. But she always felt that if you could get them young, because many of the parents were really, really enthusiastic when their children were in junior and senior infants. But a lot of our research would have indicated that children at age 8 and 9 were beginning to disconnect from school. It would have been that up until then, they child might say, I can't do this, teacher, or I need help with this. But by the time they get to 8, 9, 10, 11, they're beginning to say, I can't be bothered doing it. And so that the gap gets wider. So Concepta really spearheaded a change in the culture in many schools serving designated areas of disadvantage, where in fact they began to see parents who had the potential to be able to work with the school. And her book, Including All, is how she wanted to make that difference, and she wanted every child included, and challenged, I suppose, traditional things that happened in school where children were excluded from school on occasions, but also challenged systems within school that used language sometimes that made the engagement between home and school quite difficult.
You started off your career, Anne, as a primary teacher in a classroom. What memories stay with you today from those years in the classroom?
Well, I mentioned my kigara. That year, in fact, that I did my diploma, I had 42 senior infant boys, and I really, really, really was quite challenged that year. You can't go into school when you're not prepared. I'm passionate about being prepared and knowing the broad spectrum of how you want the day to go, but allowing yourself a little flexibility. What I feel now is maybe that there's a little bit too much breadth and not maybe as much depth. I don't think the school was as frantic when I was teaching, and I don't think maybe that the pressures from society and cure all ills of society were the same at that time. And so I think we had more time to focus on the range of the curriculum areas that were laid out within the curriculum. It must be very difficult now, and I certainly know it's something that the NCCA and the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment want to address. But I do have a certain sense now that there is a lot of breadth, and it must be very difficult for teachers to get to the stage at which that teacher had the courage to give that time to preparing her children to go to the art gallery.
A few general questions now. First of all, what is school for, or what are schools for?
I don't believe schools are for perpetuating the status quo. It's one of the elements that people who are critical of schools and schooling can say that. And there is an old Irish proverb, Duras Fasa Fifri. It's about the inquiring mind. And I think schools are about supporting children to become inquirers and to continue to ask questions and to give them the range and the breadth of skills and abilities and confidence and competence to feel as though the world is their oyster, that the knowledge that's out there that they can access in the way in which it's appropriate for them. And not everybody is an academic, and not everybody is going to go through schooling and come out the other end and be passionate like I am about ongoing professional development. But we need to ensure that children remain enthusiastic about learning, and whether they develop that through music or art or PE or drama, I don't really care. I really believe that's really important. The other element that schools do, which is probably a little concern of mine, but one that maybe society, it's something we need to reflect on, and that is that of the common good, that through schools that we understand that our gifts and our talents and our abilities are not just for ourselves, but that there is a commitment that all of us balance within our lives between us as individuals and us as members of a society, of a community, and committed to our country, but also committed to the global situation that is of concern now in the context of sustainability and other attendant matters. So I think schools do have a role there. Probably the first piece is the one that I'm the inquiring mind, because the inquiring mind will not actually be satisfied with the status quo and will always want to actually find new ways of being.
Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Yes, I had a primary school teacher, Miss O'Regan, from Athenry in County Galway. And she was my primary school teacher, and we were a very interesting class. Moya Doherty of Riverdance fame was in my class, Eileen Dunn, who reads the news, and also Bridget McManus, former Secretary General of the Department of Education. I was quite a shy person when I was young, and I struggled a little bit with reading. I found it very, very difficult when the class teacher, which was done a lot in my day, would go round the class and everybody would read two sentences or three sentences. And so I used to try and work out, depending on where my number was in the class, as to what sentences I'd have to read. And so I took no notice of what anybody else was reading. And sometimes I used to get so worked up about it, my eyes would get kind of blurred. So I struggled a bit with reading aloud, with hearing my own voice. I don't know how I ended up as president of Merino, because making speeches would have been way beyond me. But Miss O'Regan had a background in elocution. We actually used to stand up and we used to recite poetry. And I think it probably did influence Moya and Eileen Dunn in their careers and going into RTE. And there were others. There was Mrs. Parker, who was the drama teacher at the time. But I found, and I will always remember her, because she spoke to me one day and gave me a couple of strategies in relation to reading aloud. And one of the things that I would often do and would have done, even as president in Merino, I actually would have read my speeches aloud, or I would have stood up and taken some of the deep breaths before very significant occasions, or ones in particular that I might find emotional. I mean, she was great for lots of other things, but that was one that has stayed with me all my life.
And that lesson from a former teacher was recalled by Professor Anne O'Gara, former president of Merino Institute of Education and current board member of TUSLA, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen back to this programme or hundreds of others on seandelaney.com/podcasts. My book about teaching would make a great present for the teacher in your life. It is called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have and is published by Routledge. You can get it online, in bookstores, or directly from the publisher. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney wishing you well. Thank you for listening.